Welcome to another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast, brought to you by Courtroom Sciences. I am Dr. Bill Kanaski, and I am joined today by a defense attorney who's not just a client. This is a guy I'm good personal friends with, and he's always been there for me. And we've worked on a bunch of cases together. And I mean a bunch of cases together. And he is out of the great town of Rockford, Illinois, home of the Rockford Peaches.
True.
And the rock and roll band Cheap Trick.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to introduce you to my guest from Heil Royster Law, Mike Denning. Michael, how are you?
Hello, Bill. I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Did I miss? Okay, so we got Rockford Peaches is the obvious one. I don't think a lot of people know Cheap Trick. Yeah, Mommy's all right. Daddy's all right. They just seem a little weird. Is there anything else I'm missing about Rockford that I didn't know? Like, is there something else going on there?
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
You got kind of the classics. That's what everybody knows us for.
Okay, that's good. And you guys are a little bit west of Chicago. And when I lived up there, I remember taking that trip over on 90 and multiple snowstorms, by the way. I just want to let you know, on the way to work with you, I have nearly been killed multiple times on 90.
Yeah, and you never turned away. You never turned back and decided you weren't going to come. Yeah.
No, I was going to get to the Heil Royster Law Firm no matter what.
I appreciate that. Can I assume, since you've invited me on your podcast, that this is the last episode of the podcast and it will cease to exist after this? Have you reached the bottom? If you,
it will probably get. It's going to get yanked off at least Spotify.
right.
Once the YouTube people see it, yeah.
Right.
So, okay. Well, you know,
I'm happy to see this whole thing go down in flames together with you then.
Yes. And you're the guy I wanted to do that with. I just wanted to let you know. Okay. Because I couldn't quite do it. I've been trying to just, you know, get this whole thing ruined by myself, not quite getting it done.
No.
So I'm like, who do I go to? I'm going to the bullpen. I'm getting like knitting.
I've been listening. I've been hoping it goes down in flames before I get called to do it. But you keep having some people listen and you keep getting subscribers.
I know. We keep surviving over 200 episodes. So we'll do our best to screw this up. But if we don't, it's just going to keep going. It's going to keep going. So Mike does a ton of work in medical malpractice. We have our medical malpractice series, in which this podcast will be a part of. And we've covered a lot of stuff in our series. Really want to get I want Mike to get the attorney perspective of what the defendant, typically physician that Mike works with, the insurance companies that insure defendant physicians, kind of like go down the timeline of litigation. Because I think, lawsuits are stressful, no matter what it is. And if you're a healthcare provider, particularly a physician, it's the emotional process. And if you're a defense attorney, there's several stages to this. It's like the stages of grief, right? You got the stages of litigation. And I thought it'd be effective for us to kind of walk through this and get your personal perspective on kind of what you've seen at each stage. I'm sure you've seen all of it, right? And then maybe some of your personal tips and methodologies on how to deal with it. But, you know, I'm assuming, but you tell me, that one of the most difficult steps in this stage, maybe trial's the easiest by the time you get there. But I think that initial complaint has just got to be like a torpedo hitting the side of the ship, right? I mean, brutal.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, you know, that's funny that you say that, the trial thing, because I appreciate your focus for the last several months has been on kind of, you know, different aspects of mental health in the podcast.
Yes.
And, you know, setting aside entirely the mental health of defense counsel, which is not something you should set aside. And I know the plaintiff's lawyers are out there listening. I know you always have to those guys.
Yes.
They're doing the same thing. If you can keep yourself under control and keep your own stress at bay, then you got to worry about the doctor. And, you know, when that initial complaint hits them, I think what happens as defense counsel is we immediately make the phone call, right? And okay, it's another file for us, and we got to jump into the work of defending it. But so often we don't ask, how'd that make you feel? Like, how are you doing since that thing got served at home on your wife or your husband or your teenage daughter or whatever?
Yeah. That's always fun.
You know? And sometimes the answer is fine. It's my second one. It's my third one. Fine. Right. No big deal. Other times the answer is something you'd never expect to hear, which is I haven't slept. I haven't eaten.
My career's over. They're going to take my house. They're going to repossess my car. I mean, yeah, you're right. I've seen some really, you know, devastated people. Mike, I've never asked this question. I'm dying to hear this. What is the average from the time the defendant gets served to when you make the phone call? Like, how much time has gone by? Because I would assume the more time, maybe the worse this can get, right?
Absolutely. Hopefully the time is very short, but many times by the time the person gets it, wakes back up, gets up off the floor, gets it to his or her insurance company or risk manager, they get it sent off. Defense counsel is assigned. I mean, you're trying to work quickly because there's typically a deadline to respond, but you're talking a minimum of a couple of days and sometimes 2 or 3 weeks where they're immediately told, don't talk to anybody, don't access the chart. And, you know, the things that they might want to do to, you know, address the mental health they're having, the emotional distress they're having about being sued. And they're immediately told not to do any of the things that they think might help them.
Yeah. All of them. Like talk to somebody. Right.
That's I've had clients tell me a year into the litigation that they haven't even told their spouse about it. And I'm like, listen, you know.
Come on.
About it, you know, we're not going to do the deposition of your spouse, and you have to talk to somebody other than me, you know.
Yeah. It's tough. And then there's also which you kind of mentioned, which something very unfortunate. But again, when your anxiety and stress is through the roof, you'll do crazy things. Being told not to do something, and then what do? They log into the EMR.
Right.
They start snooping around, and then you got the geniuses that actually change something. I mean, how do you prevent that? Because that's obviously a panic response, right? But it happens a lot.
Well, I think it happens. It's maybe more of an imagined fear than it really is. Like, I think the times that it does happen, you know, is so surprising that somebody would try to go back in and alter a medical record that it gets so much more play or volume than all the other cases where it doesn't happen. And, you know, there's a lot of things that nobody likes about electronic health records, but it's pretty easy to find out if you've made a change and it doesn't, I've had the benefit of representing some really good doctors over the years. It just doesn't happen anymore, mostly, but what the reason that is really important for them not to do that is because there are many different takes on the audit trail, right? I have cases where the defense brings an audit trail, the plaintiff expert, the plaintiff brings an audit trail expert, and then there's a third one, and those three people don't agree with what it says, right? Or what it means. So a lot of times I say, look, even going into the record to look at it might seem like innocent behavior, but it might be taken as something else. Somebody might claim that you did change something. So that's the reason you need to wait for it to get isolated, produced in litigation. And I know you got a lot of questions about what it says and what you did, but it really is important to stay out of that. And it's for your own good, right? But that kind of takes us to the second thing in this kind of new relationship that they're forming with somebody like me. They don't know me. I mean, some cases they do, right? But all they know is I've been assigned by the health system. I've been assigned by the insurance company. They didn't go shopping for me. And so I'm telling them not to do things or to do things. They don't know yet whether to trust me. And, you know, many times I'll say, well, you know, I've been asked to represent you, or I've been assigned to represent you. And I'll get a response like, well, I didn't ask you to represent me. Yeah. Who are you? Right.
Yeah.
And so you're like, okay, we're square one in this relationship. Right. Yeah. Really. And then the first couple things we're telling them to do seem harmful to them. Right. So it's difficult, but it's important because it's for their own good.
Do many of do some of your defendant physicians think that they need to retain personal counsel as well? And when that does happen, does that kind of make things even more difficult because they got somebody else in their other ear, or like a friend that's an attorney that I'll jump on your legal team?
Yeah. that doesn't happen very often, but most of the time it comes out that, hey, I did talk to somebody briefly. I looked you up. I asked them about you, you know, and that's the problem where if you dabble in med mal defense, then it's going to be a big problem for you.
Yeah.
I've been fortunate enough that that's all I've ever really done. I love doing it. And so I have hopefully a reputation out there for, you know, oh yeah, that's somebody that you'd want to have in your corner, you know? So that usually gets avoided. And other times, you know, you can have some awkward conversations with the other lawyer. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So, okay. So as you enter deposition, one of the things I think we'll both agree on is that one of the worst things that could possibly happen in a MedMal case is vicious finger pointing between providers. How early is that something that, like, in your first couple of meetings, if they're going to do it, they start to point fingers early? Is that something that you ask them that to try to see, hey, just to want to know, is that part of your initial assessment? Like, just between us, it's attorney-client privilege. Like, where do you think what happened here? And if there is somebody to blame, tell me now so I can deal with this.
Absolutely. That happens in the first phone call.
Yeah.
Right? Because first of all, that's typically a defense mechanism that really nervous physicians will use, right? Yeah. I didn't do it. Somebody else did. And my whole thing, the way I try cases is I don't point fingers at anybody, because most of the time what happens in a medical malpractice claim is a poor outcome, right?
Yeah.
Oftentimes the outcome is litigated, not really the conduct, so to speak. So, you know, if everybody did the best that they could on that day or that series of days, then trust me, there's going to be a lot of blame thrown at everybody else by the plaintiff's lawyer. So we don't really need to do it. And if we stick, you know, with what you did, doctor, or what you did, healthcare provider, and why you did it, that's usually going to be enough, right? Without lashing out or without doing a bunch of finger pointing. You know, I've had somebody say, well, you know, how come the ER didn't call me? Or how come they didn't order this study? Yeah. And you're like, look, trust me, there's going to be a very good plaintiff's lawyer, probably from Chicago, who's going to say all that, and we don't need to say any of it.
Yeah. Again, we're going to enter the deposition phase in a second. Just another kind of interesting question. What's the impact of litigation on a defendant physician in a smaller town like yours versus over in Chicago or down in St. Louis? Because everybody knows everybody, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what's funny is that some of these physicians think that this stuff is, publicly accessible, that everybody's going to know about it. And except for the occasional press release by the plaintiff's lawyers, people generally don't know about cases, and people fail to have an appreciation for how many of these cases are pending at one point in time. So when I say to somebody, look, there are many doctors walking the same halls as you who are my clients and who have pending cases, that makes them feel a little bit better. But, you know, I've had physicians say, oh no, I'm going to be on the front of the trade magazine for a bad verdict, or, in some circumstances, look, I am the guy for this medical condition or this procedure. I can't be getting sued for a poor outcome from this procedure, right? This has to go away. And that's maybe one of the earliest things I hear during that initial meeting is make it go away. Right? How long will it take until it goes away?
Yeah.
I didn't do anything wrong. So if you just let me say I didn't do anything wrong, that will take care of everything. Just let me give my deposition. I don't need any help. Just let me give my deposition. They're going to understand I did everything the right way.
Okay. Another, I know I keep saying we're getting to deposition, but all these other questions come up. Where do you see because you and I have seen a bunch of fireworks is the physician coming in for the dep prep and they start screaming at the claims manager, like, how come you're not settling this? And that, how do you deal with that? Cause that can get ugly. That creates a lot of distrust, a lot of tension. And then you and I are trying to prep a witness and them and the claims person are screaming at each other. And it kind of blows up in your face if you don't. I mean, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so oftentimes the way I deal with that is very directly is to say, you know, some doctors are misinformed or misguided to think, you know what, if I go in and I just throw up on myself at the deposition, if I just do the terrible job, right, if I'm the worst witness ever, the case will settle. And then I don't have to worry about it anymore. And I always tell them, look, if you want the case to settle, you have to do a really good job at your deposition, not a really bad job, right? Because if you do a really bad job, what you're going to do is turn the case into the unsettleable case.
Yeah.
Right. When we were kids, when I say kids, I mean like 20 years ago, there weren't that many unsettleable cases. That's changed a little bit in terms of the motivation of some of the plaintiff's lawyers. So if you really go in and screw this up or act like you want the case to be settled, you're going to make it unsettled. Right. And then we'll be sitting together for 3 or 4 weeks in a courtroom and you're really going to be mad at me.
Exactly. So let's talk about deposition. So some of the things you and I have seen time and time and time again is these physicians or any healthcare, they bring that healthcare brain into that dep and they want to get into clinical teaching mode. And many of them think I'm going to convince the plaintiff attorney that I didn't do anything wrong. And the more I I will convince this person, and little do they know, well, we tell them this, they ignore us, right? You're not convincing anybody of anything at your deposition. Let's get that straight. But so many of them come in with that mindset of, I can convince this questioner that I'm in the right here. And then you and I are like, okay, well, here's your problem. They don't care.
Right.
They really, really don't care. They're trying to get sound bites here to go to trial with. And you could be the best witness in the world. You're not talking your way out of this case. You're talking your way into some favorable settlement. And you and I have had a lot of challenges with physicians trying to tow them down to what I would call, play the game. Play the game, right? Slow it down. Do not get into clinical professor mode. You are not talking to one of your patients or their family members. Right.
Right.
And not getting sucked into that.
Yeah. What I always tell them is because this always comes up, right? As soon as I say my piece, as soon as I tell them my side of the story, they're going to let me out. And I'm like, listen, I work against some of the finest plaintiff's lawyers in the country, right? Chicago, Illinois, has bred some of the best plaintiff's lawyers in the country. Before they put their name on the complaint, signing it and filing it, they already assume you're going to tell a good story and do a good job as a witness. Yeah. They don't care. They already assume you're going to do that because they're business people and they assume the worst. So they assume you're going to come in and be a tremendous witness and tell them that they're wrong. What you said is exactly right. What they're looking for is, and of course the doctor assumes that this is going to be a level playing field, right? That the deposition is going to be an intellectually honest examination of what happened. And I always say, listen, if you're looking for the truth of what happened, a courtroom or a deposition in Northern Illinois is not where you start, because this isn't like us sitting down with a beer and a patient chart and saying, hey, what happened? Could this be better? Tell me what you think. I'll tell you what I think. At the time of the deposition, it's simply about whether an amount of money should be paid for the conduct that can be shown through the record. And all of the questions are directed at the witness to increase that amount of money. And all of the answers given by the witness can either increase that amount of money or get us to a zero, right? Which is what we're looking to do.
And they struggle to comprehend that. And because I think they go in thinking, now, even though deposition testimony is sworn testimony and can be used at trial, it's not trial testimony. It's not. Right. But they go in there thinking like, hey, I've seen them, I've seen a few good men, right? I'm just going to tell them I didn't order the code red. I didn't do it.
Right.
Right. I want the truth. You can't handle the truth. I did not order the code red. Like they think if they do that, that's going to somehow be a winning formula.
Well, and here's the problem with that instinct that they have, right? The instinct that they have is if I just say what I did, everything will be fine, but you're not simply going to be asked to say what you did. Yeah. You're going to be asked about what you did in a very weird, hypothetical kind of structurally, kind of amorphous way. It's not going to be exactly like, hey, tell me what you did. And the other problem with that is the instinct to say, I'm just going to say what I did, will prevent them from adequately preparing for the deposition, right? That's just your shorthand way of saying, I'm good. I'm just going to say what I did. And I say, listen, you're not anywhere near ready for this. And your instinct to just go back to what you said. Now, typically I tell the client, listen, we are going to tell the truth no matter what, because that's how it works, right? Can't change that. So we're going to tell the truth, but that's not enough just to get you ready for the deposition. And your kind of assumption that, oh, I'll just do that and everything will be fine, yeah, isn't going to work.
It's not. And so kind of another hiccup here. I mean, I really, it's like talking to guys like you, Mike, is why I'm so glad I never went to law school, because I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do this on multiple cases. It's got to be really hard, because all of your clients are very different. Now, granted, I work with different witnesses on different cases, but I'm kind of like a Navy SEAL or SWAT team. Like, I come in, I hop off the helicopter, I do all my work, I hop back on the helicopter at the end of the day or the next day, and then I'm off to the next battle. You're living with this for what, 3, 4, sometimes 5 years, right?
Yeah, before COVID. Now after COVID, it's a bit longer. But the challenge there is, and I do love the challenge of kind of having my head on a swivel and learning to, you know, one area of medicine and changing a half hour later to another. But the part of the challenge is identifying where the doctor is and starting over every single time, right? So like if I have three initial meetings in a week, by the time I get to the third initial meeting, I'm gonna be like, yeah, remember, it's like what we talked about on Tuesday and this, that. But of course they weren't there. So everything's got to be slowed down so that you can identify where they are on this kind of emotional spectrum, right? Because a lot of times their defense, they want to look like ready for this. They want to look, you know, strong. And so they're not telling you, I'm not eating, I'm not sleeping, I'm scared. You know, in the example of a foreign born physician, which you've helped me with in the past, am I going to go to jail?
Yeah.
Am I going to get deported?
Yeah.
I mean, that these are questions that I've had where I've had to say, okay, no, let's slow way down. Right. Because all those things are going to interfere with you at the time of the deposition.
Yeah. You and I have probably worked more with more foreign born physicians than me and any other attorney. So you and I have been down this road multiple times. We've heard all that. They're going to take my house. I'm going to jail.
Right.
Like, they're taking me in handcuffs. I remember the one time, I think we were like an hour in, and this guy's sweating bullets, and he's like, wait, they're not taking my house and I'm not going to jail? We're like, no. And you saw this like relief, and he sat back. He's like, can I go call my wife and tell her? We're like, shit, yes, go call your goddamn wife. Like, oh my God. Like, they really thought that, because the cultural differences were so huge. So I think it's very important. I think you would agree, recognizing the cultural difference, and you may have to educate that physician differently than an American born physician, number one. But then number two, how many of these foreign born physicians have you defended that come in that have it pretty set that there's going to be essentially racism because they're from Syria, or because they're from Africa, or because they're from Ukraine, or wherever they're from? I've seen a lot of that too, saying, like, well, for example, you know, a lot of the foreign born physicians end up in the Rockfords of the world. There's a lot of jobs around there, right? Some of them are in downtown Chicago, where it's a far more of a blended, so many different cultures. Well, you know, how many Syrian physicians are in Rockford, right? Yeah. How many Syrians, period, are in Rockford? And then they're like, wait, jury of my peers. This is not a jury of my peers. This is unfair. How do you deal with that part of it? Because I think they have some pretty valid points when it comes to that.
I think they have some valid concerns, but, you know, and again, you've had just some tremendous lawyers on this podcast, and I feel almost silly being on it because I don't have enough.
But you're the best looking. You're the best looking. I'm not looking for brains. I'm looking for looks, man.
I'm gonna tell my identical twin brother you said that.
Yes, I know.
But I have tried a lot of these, and I try a lot of them in these outlying counties. And one thing that remains true, while there is, you know, the smaller town you get to, you know, the increased risk you feel like you have of that dynamic going on, you know, with a little bit of a an outsider type element or a potential, you know, even if there's a language barrier that makes it more difficult too. The key is figuring out a way to communicate both to that doctor and then ultimately to the jury that this doctor is in your town trying their best in a town that doesn't have a lot of, maybe, for example, American born doctors, right? So I can remember trying a case in a neighboring county where this is 10 years ago, where it's got 50,000 people in it. And the judge says, well, who knows the defendant? Everybody's hand goes up. Because he's the guy you go see when you're sick.
Yeah.
Right. And so I kind of told him, like, look, there's that going on right there. But they have to, their instinct sometimes can be, hold on, I don't sound like most of the people that are going to be sitting in that jury. I don't look like most of those people. And so, you know, that's bad for me. And I say, you know, juries, we don't give them enough credit sometimes. They're pretty good at setting that stuff aside. And we're pretty good after talking with people like you to figuring out the jurors who won't set that stuff aside and making sure they don't make the jury.
Yeah. So you get them through deposition. And again, you know, the system that I preach, and you and I have been down the road many times before, it's a less is more system. You're not going to win the case at the deposition, right? We want to survive this process. We want to embrace the facts. So we have a couple things we want to do. We want to embrace what we did. We don't want to dodge anything. We don't want to be evasive. No, this is what I ordered this test at this time. Yes, that's exactly what I did. I think the highest level witness skill in medical malpractice is embracing what you didn't do.
Right? Absolutely.
That's the key.
Yeah, while also having in your head the knowledge of how everything played out.
Yeah.
Right? That's the hindsight bias, right? Where you go back and you say, why didn't I order the MRI? Why didn't I react to the lab value? And it's like, well, let's try to put yourself back in that situation, because that's exactly where the attack is coming from, right? Everybody in the deposition, me, the plaintiff's lawyer, everybody else gets to ask questions, having known the result of how this all took place. You're the only one who had to make a note of anything without knowing how it's going to work. Right. Yeah. And so you have to have a lot of things top of mind when you go to give the deposition, but being calm, credible, and embracing the truth is usually like, and I will tell people, you take an oath, right? You take the oath at the beginning, and it's to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So when somebody asks you a leading question full of a bunch of half truths, or sometimes things that aren't facts in the case, why would you be agreeing with that?
Yeah, exactly.
You're not following the oath. And I told you, I want you to tell the truth. So the truthful thing to do is to disagree with that person, even if it's hard to do.
Yeah. And the brain has a lot of protective mechanisms. That's what the brain does. And so particularly on those questions where a good plaintiff attorney points out things that were not done. Now, the explanation for that's crystal clear, because it wasn't clinically indicated, something like that, right? But then you get this list of, well, you know, you could have called the cardiologist at 2 o'clock. You didn't. You could have called the radiologist to get these results at 4 o'clock. You didn't do it. Right. And they start going down this list, and you see the doctor in their chair going like this, down, down, down. And it's like, oh, man, I'm getting killed in this step. When you have to train them to say, that's correct. Yeah, you're right. I did not make that call. You're right. And own their conduct, both the positive and the negative. That's really important. My father-in-law did a full tour in Vietnam at the worst time, and then came back from Vietnam and was a firefighter for 30 years. He's got some amazing stories, Mike. But I asked him, like, how the hell do you do that? And he's like, you have to train your brain to run towards the bullets and towards the fire. And your brain doesn't want to do that. But that's the only way to stay alive, if you think about it. If you actually run from the bullets and run from the fire, everybody's going to die. Like, it doesn't work that way. And so you have to train the witness, run towards the fire and hug it. It's okay. It's warm, right? But the more you run and try to distance yourself, you can run, but you can't hide.
Right.
And it looks terrible.
And you've heard me say this before too. Like, that's the high level stuff that we both expect.
It's hard.
But we need, but if you don't do the minimum stuff, and what I always say is, like, if you don't come knowing the facts of your care and treatment, and having been a little self-critical, gone over with me, now you're trying to figure out whether you did order the lab test and then defend why you didn't, right? And so, like, sometimes I'll send the records to my client and I'll say, bring those to the meeting. They come to the meeting and they don't have anything. And I'm like,
Come on,
I mean,
man.
I have them here, but what are we doing, guys? Like, come on, you know. Oh, no, it's all up here. I go, yeah, no, it's not.
No, it's not.
It's
No,
not.
it's
It's
not.
not up there, right? But if you have a command of the facts and a confidence of the care that was administered, then you can answer the hard questions. But if you're looking to figure that out and answer the hard question, man, you're just red meat.
I worked at the internal medicine hospitalist this morning. And the question during our mock questioning was, well, doctor, how much do you remember about this particular patient visit? You go, oh, I remember everything. I remember everything. And I'm like, time out. No, you don't. I can promise you, you don't. But you see that? That's like that. That's the brain saying, I got to protect myself. I've got to have all the answers to all the questions. Because if I don't have all the answers, Mike, I look stupid or I look incompetent. And so how do you work with your physicians to say, not only is it okay to not know or not remember something, it's impossible to know everything and it's okay. You're not hurting your case.
Lately, I've been going back to the oath, right? So like, because really you start, especially with new witnesses that have never given testimony before. That's the first thing that's said on the record is the oath. So if you really don't remember this and you don't have any custom and practice to rely on, why are you answering the question as to what you remember as if you remember something?
Yeah, they don't.
You're not telling the truth. And I told you at the beginning, we will get through this. I can get you through this if you tell the truth.
You know what, and, Mike? They mishear the oath. What is the oath? To do what?
To tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. Although I will tell you that we had a witness one time.
I remember.
Not want to take the oath, and I hear him start, you know, and then after a couple of pages of testimony, he's making a good point, you know. But generally speaking, if your witness gets past the oath, you've checked that first box, right?
Yeah. If you say it depends to that one, you're in big trouble. But I think with physicians and other healthcare professionals, I think they hear it differently. I think they raise their right hand, and what they hear is, I promise to do my best on every question and tell you everything I know and volunteer as much information. I will give you as much information I know, so help me God. I think that's what they hear. It's more of an effort-based oath. Well, it's not. It's an honesty-based oath, right?
Right.
It's
right.
not effort. It's not an effort-based oath.
It's not. And you know, and I always tell people, look, no matter how nervous you get, no matter how upset you get, no matter how lost you get in the question, I better not hear new information for the first time.
Is that the worst?
Right. Because, I mean, that's like, help me help you is what I think the line was, or, you know, I can't do anything with that. Like if I hear for the first time during the deposition, oh, you don't have all the medical records. There's a separate chart that was kept over on the B floor in the surgical wing. Can you go get that? Yeah, we can go get that. Oh, terrific. That's wonderful.
I'm dying to know when that happens. How in the world do you maintain your composure? How do you not just lose your mind and maybe even physically drag your witness and maybe beat him up in the room next? Like, how do you keep your composure?
The one thing that you can always remember is the plaintiff's lawyer is watching both of you.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give him the satisfaction.
Because you have to be like you want to look at your witness going, what the where'd that come from? Now when you drag him down the hall for the first break, do you like throw him up against the wall and shake him? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. You know, there's way too many parallels to parenting.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you rely on some instincts there. But
yeah, it's like talking to your 10-year-old, right? We just talked about this, son.
Right. 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 Yeah. And I mean, you know, a lot of times I always tell the client, look, I'm going to be honest with you, but you got to be honest with me, right?
Yeah.
So like, if we're getting, and you probably have seen this, if we're getting ready for a deposition and the answer to the mock question is terrible, and they say, how'd I do? I'm going to say, bad.
Yeah.
Right? But bad is good because we can work upward from bad.
Yeah.
Right? We can get to it. We know we can call it what it is. That was bad. Let's go up from there, right? So a little bit positivity on top of some real honesty usually is helpful.
Yeah. We don't like surprises at deposition. We'll end that there. Okay, let's move into the next phase and then we'll wrap this up with trial. Expert phase. So I think there's a couple of things that can happen here, right? So you start to get expert opinions. And I think What you would like is some expert to come back and say, your person did everything great. And sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
But then I think the two challenges are probably when you get a negative review by another mm-hmm. provider, but then what always happens is when the plaintiff expert submits their report and your person reads it, the like smoke physically coming out of their ears, anger. Yeah.
You're kind of jumping ahead when you say that that they read it.
Oh, they
right?
Am I?
So I'm always like, listen, guys, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to send you some stuff and I want you to read it and tell me what you think about it. Cause I'm not a radiologist and I'm not an anesthesiologist, yeah. although I play one on TV and now on YouTube and on a podcast, but like I can remember going to talk to a physician one time about preparing his expert witness disclosure for himself at the end of the case. And I get into his office and there are like 10 envelopes that have our little Kyle Royster red logo on it. And none of them are opened.
Oh, jeez.
And he goes, yeah, those are sitting there. Which one do you want? Which one of those should I open?
Oh, man.
And I was like, yeah, open all of them, man. What are you talking about? Right. But what I try to emphasize is, you know, my clients never meet my experts until after the expert testifies at trial. Right. So I don't need them as much when our expert opinions are coming in, although I typically like to go talk about either concerns or areas where there's some, you know, disagreement between the doctor and the expert. But where I really need help is when the plaintiff's expert report comes in. And I always tell the client, listen, I know that after the deposition, you want to put this in a box and shove it under your desk, right? You do not want to be reminded about this case. I know when you get an email from me or a text or a letter, I know that causes this whole emotional roller coaster to start all over again. But I need you, right? Like, I need you to explain to me why this report is either good or bad, where there are weaknesses. And again, if you sit down and talk with me and trust me and help me do this, we can get a better outcome for you. But sometimes getting the doctor to re-engage in the case at the expert witness stage is so difficult because of all the scar tissue from the complaint, from the deposition, from all the other stuff.
Yeah. And so then, you know, you get to this point, let's talk about trial.
Yeah.
And then we'll wrap this up at the top of the hour. It's got to be a heck of a wake up call. Because listen, I mean, I imagine you're telling your clients, going, listen, you know, 97% of cases settle, right? Come on. And then there's got to be that phone call where you're like, okay, we had a mediation, it didn't work. Like, there's this kind of like point of no return where we're going to war. How do you have that discussion and keep them mentally fit?
It's somewhat the opposite. I mean, I always tell my doctors, listen, it's going to be you and me in a courtroom a year from now. Okay. That's how I'm just telling you, that's how it's going to go. There's going to be some other defendants who are going to settle, but you're a good witness. We have a good expert and this case should get tried. So you should fully expect for it to get tried. And I tell them that at the expert discovery schedule stage, right? And then I set up numerous meetings with them before trial, even if there is settlement discussion in the background, because we're going to get ready for trial. And I say, this is how this is going to go. So it's never a surprise the wrong way, right? It's always a surprise the right way.
Okay. I like that tactic. So you tell them, just plan on going to trial. Let's talk a little bit about trial. Many of your clients, I'm sure it's their first trial, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of education. Then you and I typically, I get re-involved at that point. So it's like, okay, well now I've got to teach this doctor
the opposite.
Talk to a jury, right? Versus talk to a plaintiff attorney in a deposition setting. And so, you know, some of the obvious things are like, you know, dress code, body language, right? I think those things we can kind of, I mean, it's important to talk about those, but I think it's important, particularly to the first timer and mixing in with the foreign born who like, they have no idea what an opening statement is. Right. And I think you have to probably mentally set up their expectations of here are the phases of trial. Here's what's going to happen. You know, plaintiff goes first and we go first. And then plaintiff goes first and then we go first, from voir dire to openings to witnesses to closings. And here's the role of the judge, and to explain all that. And I would, at least from what I was always told, I think most witnesses, particularly defendants, not just necessarily healthcare providers, any defendant that's been to trial for the first time, their only exposure to the legal system has been movies and TV.
Yep.
And they think it's going to be Jim Carrey and Liar Liar, right?
Yeah.
And it's not like that. It's different. So I imagine you spend a lot of time up front preparing them. I call it, where I always start the witness training, as you know this too well, is I always start by saying, listen, it's a 2-week trial. Of this 2-week trial, 5% of it, five, not 50, not 35, 5%, you're going to be on that witness stand testifying. 95% of the time, you're sitting in a chair next to Mike Denning.
Right.
There's a lot going on, right? So we're going to focus today on that 5% of your, if you're called as an adverse witness, right? That's questioning with your rehabilitation or direct examination, depending on which way you got. We're going to spend the rest of the day on that. But there's this other 95% of things happening. Opening statements, fact witnesses, expert witnesses, where you're sitting there at the table and other things are going on. But guess who the jury's watching? They're watching you. They're watching your... And so I start everything like, you've got to be... I always tell every witness, Mike, I go, if you say something wrong on the stand, Mike can fix it. Any words, you could say, I was the second shooter in the grassy knoll on November 16th. Mike can get you out of that.
Yeah,
Mike can get you out of that on rehabilitation or direct examination. But I go, you have a shitty attitude. You non-verbally lose your shit. You're rolling your eyes. You're smirking. You're huffing and puffing like a child. At counsel's table and the jury sees that, you are toast because Mike Denny can't fix that. He can fix words, but he can't fix that. Talk to me a little bit about how you handle demeanor issues.
So the demeanor comes from somewhere, right? It comes from something. It's either like an audience bias where the doctor thinks that the jury's watching him and that kind of behavior helps, or it's coming from expectations that haven't been met. Things are surprising him or her. And that's my fault, right? Because my job is to tell him, look, they're going to say some things that are going to be hurtful. They're going to say some things that are going to be embarrassing.
Yeah.
They're going to use the medical terminology wrong. They're going to argue things that didn't happen that you think should have happened. And all of it has to be exactly like what we expected. And I tell them exactly what you tell them, which is no matter what anyone is saying, they're looking at you. And exactly. Most of that, like most of the tone has to be set by defense counsel. Like I don't like going into trials where behind the scenes at the office, we're running around, we look disorganized, we lack confidence. Trials with us, with me specifically, are calm, quiet endeavors that appear to be organized. Now, sometimes when the client goes home for the night, we're like, oh crap. With that, you know, we're going to be working till 2 a.m.
Yeah.
But I can remember a couple years ago, we tried a case. Doctor wasn't going to take the stand until third or fourth day. And there was all this nonverbal stuff going on next to me, you know, shaking back and forth and the knees bobbing. And I think he was going to testify on the third day. So the night before, I said, I'll meet you at your office, 6 p.m. Let's go get a bite to eat. I'll meet you at your office. And I left all my stuff in the car and I sat with him. And he said, where's the stuff? We got to talk about the stuff. I said, look, we talked about the stuff. We talked about the information in this case. What's going on with you? And I mean, it sounds like touchy-feely, but I'm like, what is on your brain? What's on your mind? So for 2.5 hours, we got through all of the emotional crap that he was bringing into the courtroom every day. And I said, okay, can we agree you're not bringing that with you tomorrow? Can we leave it here right now? Because I said, look, you're a very competitive dude. He said, yeah. And I go, not as competitive as me. I really like winning. In fact, there's nothing more in the world I like than to win. And if you screw up my chances to win by coming in there with all of this crap on your brain, you're going to screw up my chances to win. I usually get a laugh and get some kind of comfort. And then the next day he did, in a very difficult case, very well. So you have to prepare them for what's happening and try to understand what's going on with them in their head. And this is kind of that emotional spectrum of now all the stuff that was happening in the lawsuits happening in front of 12 patients, 12 crews, right?
Yeah.
You got to get ready for that.
So what do you think? I've got my opinion on this, but everybody's different. And I'm not talking about the physician or the defendant on the stand testifying. I'm talking that other 95% of other things going on. What do you think is the most stressful part of a trial for the defendant sitting at counsel's table? Because some would argue, you know what, when that plaintiff attorney gives that opening statement, oh, it's vicious. Like that like rips your heart. Like it's really difficult for the defendant to deal with. But then I've heard some defendants say, you know, that's a plaintiff attorney. That's their job. I ain't worried about them. Then others have said, when that family member gets on the stand or the widow and they're crying, like that's the hardest part. And it's like, nah, that's not the hardest part. It's when the plaintiff's expert witness, right? Someone from their industry who's getting paid a lot of money to shred their care. I think all of those could be the worst, depending on who you are. What's your experience with that?
Yeah.
I think they can all be really bad and really tough.
Yeah, I totally agree. And again, to the extent that any of them are really bad, that's my fault. Right? Because I spend a lot of time telling them what's coming in the opening. Because if what you hear in the opening is a surprise, I have fallen on my face, right? I've not done my job. I should be able to tell them pretty much word for word what's coming out of the plaintiff's lawyer's mouth. Many physicians have deal with death and poor outcomes that result from really good care. And so I often find that while the physicians feel a lot of empathy for the family member, that's not difficult. I think the most difficult thing is hearing the criticisms from the plaintiff's expert. And
yeah, it's hard.
Resisting the urge to write me a bunch of notes, right, about what's happening. I know what's about to be said, like, and I'm ready for it. So we're just going to sit there and listen. We're going to take it in. And there's always cross-examination that follows. So if you didn't like what's happening on direct, just wait, you know. Yeah,
it's coming.
And then you can, you know, you can still lack perspective, though. I can remember a trial years ago where we just destroyed the plaintiff's expert on the stand. I mean, it was a little inside baseball in order to see it, but we weakened him so substantially that it was from a lawyer's perspective, we had a good day. And we get back to the office and the guy was like, I think that guy hurt us. That's what the doctor said. I think he really hurt us. And we were like, are you kidding me? It was great.
Yeah.
And that was just, again, that was a failure of communication between us. We should have told him, like, look, these guys are not taking the stand because they're not going to hurt you. There's a lawsuit because we escaped summary judgment and they're going to come say some things that are really going to hurt. But that's right. That you're supposed to get your nose bloodied when the plaintiff's expert's on the stand.
Yeah.
So they got, again, if there's a lot of that reaction from the doctor, that's my fault in managing expectations. Right.
Yeah. So now I'm going to have you back on the podcast and I may have you back on a panel because I want to talk about the actual trial testimony in a different section because it's a world of its own. Mike, I'm telling you, it's 95% of other stuff going on and managing your client's emotions and expectations, communication, 95%. So we'll cover trial testimony down the road. Well, and okay, so
as you know, it can be one of the most important parts because even though all of us defense lawyers like our expert witnesses, it's not what carries the day.
Yeah, exactly. So you go into your closing with your client, you deliver your closing, and then the judge gives his jury instructions, and now it's you and your client, maybe going down the street to the coffee shop, or the tavern to watch a couple innings of the Cubs game while you're waiting on a call. What are your techniques and tactics to keep your? Because now you have no control. It's just you're waiting for the decision. How do you keep them from not losing their mind and staying positive and keeping their eye on the ball? And because that's probably just the worst feeling, waiting. And oh no, what if they don't call back in an hour? Or what if it takes a day? What if, oh no, they want to go home. Wait, if they go home, that means I'm guilty, right? Like there's all these weird things going through your mind and no one really knows.
Yeah, so that's so hard. First of all, watching my Cubby is not gonna make anybody feel better about anything. So we don't do that.
Oh, I'm gonna end with that.
Yeah, no, but that is difficult. But again, if you've forged enough of a relationship with the client and you've done your job, generally speaking, they understand that there's nothing else that can be done. There's no more objections can be made or arguments that can be made or questions that can be asked. And if you have the case evaluated properly, and if you've done all of the things that you should have done before the case, there's not a whole lot of stress or anxiety over what might happen, right? It just is in the hands of 12 people who are not trained physicians. And, you know, we can laugh about some things and have some levity, and we try to do that. I always end, you know, like, oh, can you believe the plaintiff's lawyer did that? Or can you believe I did that one thing, said that thing? It's only funny if we win. I always say that at the end. Yeah. Look, all these stories are only funny if we win. If we lose in spite of that guy tripping over his, you know, a medical skeleton and falling on the floor, then that's not a funny story. But I think a little bit of levity, a little bit of calm, you know, some quiet, you know, some time away from each other for a few hours, if we think it's going to be a long time, is you know, and a lot of people don't, I've seen lawyers not have their clients wait with them or not come back to take the verdict. I think that's a mistake. I think because, you know, so often you're doing what you're doing as the lawyer, right? And you're not kind of paying attention to the client because you got a job to do. And if you can do your job, it's better for that person.
Yeah.
But I can remember bringing a client back with me, and I had tried two cases or at least one other case for this client. And the jury came back, got a not guilty. And I talked to my associate, looked over at this physician, and he was nearly in tears, shoulders shaking. And I said, hey, I put my hand on his shoulder. I said, what's wrong? He said, I got to go call my dad. And he never had said anything throughout the trial that this was weighing so heavily on him. And I thought, that's a lesson for me to ask every day, how you doing? Right. How are you doing? Like, I don't just mean how you doing. I mean, how are you doing? Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to have them there, but you know, a little bit of time apart from each other is also okay too, while that process is playing out.
Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think this is invaluable information. And again, I want to have you back for actual trial testimony and tactics and cross-examination. I think there's a lot to, we could go for a whole nother hour doing that, but I want to keep that separate. But I think this was fantastic. I'm going to put you on the spot now. Chicago Cubs, over or under 85 games? Last year, they won 83 games. Over, under 85, where are you at?
So I like the Cubs. I like all the hitters. Generally speaking, it's the pitching that's thin.
Yeah,
maybe getting a little thinner recently.
Yeah,
what? Yeah, and you know, from the game that we were at, the Christopher Morel game last summer, where he hit that late home run, which
insane,
I think
by the way,
you wanted to leave that game. Possibly,
I totally wanted to leave. Listen, I was guilty as charged. I admit liability. I wanted to leave, and I still have you on video losing your mind.
When he hit that go-ahead homer. I'm going to go – I'm an eternal optimist. I'm going for the over. I really do think – I think they're going to be at 87 or 88 wins this year.
I would like that. We need to schedule our annual Heil Royster Courtroom Sciences coming together at Wrigley Field. So please look at your calendar, and let's look for this summer to see when we can get over to Wrigley again.
I recall we did one of those in early April, and when it snows at a Bears game, it's one thing, but when it snows at Wrigley Field, it was
that was one of the coldest days of my life. Opening day in the bleachers with a 27 mile per hour wind.
Yeah,
that was not. That was, I guess, gotta tell you, it was fun for like a little bit, and then you're like, why am I here? Like, what was I thinking? It's opening day, and this is, I'm like, this is not fun. This is cold.
Yeah, especially then your mind starts going to all the different high def cameras and TV angles they have, and you're like, I could probably get a pretty good view of this game.
Yeah, we could go to, you know, Casey Moran's has the game on right now, and it's really warm over there.
Got it. Hey, well, thanks for having me on. This has been super fun. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Mike Denning, Heil Royster, Rockford, Illinois, to our guests or to our audience. Thank you so much for participating in this edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast. We will see you next time.